I'm going to begin our talk this morning about facing fear with readings about universalism, because it forms and informs our larger sense of meaning. That's what we call our faith, as it were. Universalism, as I say, in the order of service, orients our lives in relation to love rather than in reaction to fear. It is the background, which then can become the foreground to help keep fear from shutting us off from possibility and hope, love and life. Notice the difference in your feeling of your experience of this morning and being present here, and if you had stayed at home afraid of the winds and the rains because of something you heard rather than what you found out. This is from a treatise on atonement by Hosea Ballou, and he's credited with being the most effective early spokesperson for universalism in America. And this treatise was first published in 1805, and the last edition released in 1832. There is nothing in heaven above nor on earth beneath that can do away with sin but love. And we have reason to be eternally thankful that love is stronger than death, that many waters cannot quench it, nor the floods drown it, that it hath power to remove the moral maladies of humankind and overcome fear. O love, thou great physician of souls, what work hast thou undertaken? This next reading is from the book Hosea Ballou, The Challenge to Orthodoxy, and it's a biography by Ernest Cassera, published in 1961. Universalism as a movement is dated from the landing of the Englishman John Murray on the New Jersey shore in 1770. He preached his first Universalist sermon on September 30th of 1770, the first one on American soil. A restless, active spirit, he traveled widely through the colonies preaching the message that all people will be saved. The Orthodox clergy and many of their followers were convinced that Murray's doctrine was of the devil. Opposition to his activities arose wherever he went, and it often took violent forms. But universalism was, quote, in the air. With the rise of the democratic spirit, in the era of the American Revolution, it is not surprising that the Calvinistic belief in the election of some people to everlasting life and the condemnation of others to everlasting hellfire for no apparent reason should be challenged. Universalist sentiments arose naturally among those who could not accept an aristocracy of the spirit any more than they could accept a political aristocracy. Baptist authorities at that time virulently rejected this universalist heresy and called it, quote, the lowest sort of vileness. For what was to keep people on the straight and narrow path if the fear of hell were taken away? Certainly a believer in this universalism would lie, cheat, indulge in, and commit every possible sin. I share that with you because that sentiment has not gone away. Here's a story shared by the Reverend Mark Ward. Hosea Ballou was out riding one day with a Baptist preacher, and the two were arguing theology. At one point, the Baptist minister said, "Brother Ballou, if I were a universalist and feared not the fires of hell, I'd hit you over the head and steal your horse and saddle." Ballou then looked over him and replied, "My brother, if you were a universalist, the idea would never occur to you." It's been about 5 years since Mark Ward shared this story, told by our colleague, the Reverend Jake Morrill, minister of the UU Church in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. But it's one that could have happened, might have happened, yesterday. Jake recalls how he was stopped at a traffic light when he looked across and he noticed that the car he was facing going the other direction had a front license plate with a cartoon of a Confederate soldier holding a rebel flag. You've seen it. Beside the cartoon, Jake read the words, "Forget hell." At that, he says, his Universalist heart swelled and he thought to himself, "That's right. Even you, Johnny Reb, who fought to sustain the fathomless misery of countless enslaved people, even you see that you can't escape the all-conquering power of love. Forget hell is right." It was then, he says, that he saw the comma. Forget hell. Forget hell. At least as something that exists in a cosmic way. Universalism says that you don't need to orient your life in relation to an overarching fear. It does not come from God. It is not a given of existence that you have to live in and with because of who you are. You don't have to move through your life guided by fear because it isn't existential. Practice universalism. Practice orienting your life in relation to love rather than in relation to fear. Possibility and hope, love and life are real. It may be simple to say, but it's not always easy to do. And yes, I realize that there are hells of human making and also conditions and times in our lives that make it difficult, if not impossible, to see the sun and reach for and even consider joy. But it does make a difference to know that we live and move in a larger understanding that intends our good, where our means everyone. Universal love. And the angst of fear is something we can try to do something about. I think, too, that forget, comma, hell. In other words, with the comma, maybe without the accent, forget. Hell. But with the comma and without the flag also works for us. We will not forget others in our work for inclusion and justice, one human family. I've pointed out before that what may feel like a historical theological distinction that I'm making up here still lives in our community. It's not an abstraction, it's one that affects our modern lives. You've heard me tell about how when my daughter Hannah was in fourth grade, a friend at Hendersonville Elementary asked her if she believed in God. Hannah replied with some version of her Unitarian Universalism that I know came across as, "Well, not so much." The friend told her that it was very important that she did, quote, "Because if she didn't, he would come down with a gun and shoot her." Close quotes. That friend was living and choosing how to be in the world based on fear, oriented by fear. Fear of a violent God. Not everyone views God that way. We orient with a whole bunch of people who don't. Hannah, on the other hand, has lived without such existential fear. She lives more with and from an existential sense of goodness. Now, don't confuse the word goodness with niceness or think that living from a sense of goodness isn't tough, strong, resilient, or challenging. Hannah feels passionately about issues of justice. She gets outraged at unfairness and feels the challenge of facing her fears and anxieties as they present. She also is learning how to blend these things together well as she grows up. But Hannah didn't adopt her universalist perspective the way most of us did. It isn't an ism in her life. It is the way and it is the family, the system in which she grew up. So she absorbed it. And because this universalist orientation and this congregation were here, are here, she carries it with her as a part of her foundational way of being in the world. When you look around this sanctuary, Think of it as more than a pleasant space that just happens to be here and that you came to on this Sunday morning. Appreciate what the people accomplished, what you accomplished by taking what? A Baptist box designed under the influence of a fear-based theology with bad carpet and transforming it into a Unitarian Universalist embrace. Boldly inviting the universe in to this space and sending us out into the world. By doing so, you placed yourselves firmly in the ongoing stream of universalism in these mountains. By the 1830s, enough universalist congregations had been established in North Carolina that a statewide universalist convention was held in 1830. So this fellowship, UUFH, emerges from and continues a tradition and presence that's been a part of the experience of Western North Carolina for almost 200 years. We don't put faith in fear. We don't put our faith, our sense of meaning in fear to orient us to what is good. So if you think about it, fear then isn't a part of our faith. It isn't a part of how we make meaning. Yes, fear exists and is a real part of our daily lives, but not as part of our life organizing larger structure. When you come into this sanctuary, know that this sanctuary is inclusive, not existentially divided, and know that this sanctuary is not scared. Jim, you say there are very real things to be afraid of. Yes. We have to feel fear in order to keep ourselves safe. Fear anticipates or alerts us to danger. There are things to fear, things that can hurt us and threaten our lives. In our opening hymn, what is perhaps the key word that you don't notice or think about very much and that we sing over every time and in every verse trying to get to the feelings of peace? What's the word? It's every. Every. If every woman, if every man, if every nation, not every woman, not every man, not every nation dreams a sweet dream of peace. And there are people who don't wish us well. And so we live with awareness and are mindful of and for our safety. As I was thinking about fear, I thought too back to times when I've really felt afraid. Not just anxious or concerned. That happens every day. But really, really scared. When I did that, one time came right to mind. It was a time when I used the word that I truly felt terrified. That's the word I use to describe the feeling. The word terror has become overused, but it's the feeling of extreme fear. I've done whitewater kayaking. I've done different things. I always keep it back from the level. Anyway, I won't go into that. But I haven't felt terrified in those spaces. But this moment was riding a roller coaster in Carowinds. My daughter Hannah and her friend Paige were about 10 or 12, I think, and they were in the row behind me. I thought I was good with coasters. I love them. But I'm good with coasters when I feel securely strapped in. This one just has a T-bar that secures halfway up your thighs. And then it goes over. It goes up and then drops right there. And you feel like you're flying out. You're only connected by right here, your thigh. It doesn't have the shoulder thing. When we went over the drops around the bends, I felt like if I relaxed my leg just a little bit, I was in danger of flying out. And I feel it now. I was so scared for Hannah and Paige, and there was nothing I could do. I tried to reassure myself about, well, you know, they know what they're doing, and they have safety tests and the safety of the ride, and that's been proved out later that I was just talking bunk to myself. But I was still terrified. I still felt helpless. I can still recall the feelings. I looked up the particular coaster so I could be specific this morning, and it's still there. I couldn't remember the name, but I recognized it by the color and the steepness of the drops and the curves. And you know what the name is? You might even guess it. It's called the Intimidator. They knew how to name it. Intimidate. You know what it means? It means to make, think about it, timid or fearful, to frighten, especially to compel or deter as if by threats. And then you look up timid. Timid means lacking in courage, boldness, or determination. I couldn't ride another coaster all day. And there's no way you're going to get me back on that thing. When one is intimidated, courage and boldness and determination are taken away. Fear shuts us off from possibility and hope. The courage of one's heart pulls back. And yesterday, I watched the ride from a GoPro camera perspective on YouTube. And Hannah and Paige are grown up now. I started to say they aren't in danger, but they're grown up now, and they're off doing their own things. And I was sitting in my living room, but I felt those feelings all over again. 6 hours after simply watching the ride, I still feel a little of the hangover from being terrified. This morning, as I repeat it and say to you, I'm feeling that sense of fear and being terrified. I feel how I was intimidated. I wonder then, too, about the effects of the images as I watch that we are exposed to every day and multiple times. What is the effect of the commentary and the language that we are exposed to over and over every time, every day? What is the effect? How much are we intimidated, made timid or fearful? If we were in an interaction right now that required me to be fully present and be in conversation with you in a way that was listening and hearing and being my best self, I couldn't do it because at this moment I'm scared. My heart's beating. I'm in that space where I can feel it out in my limbs. So what is the effect? How much are we intimidated? How much are we made timid or fearful? How much is our courage or determination diminished even a little bit by the videos and reports that we watch and that we hear and that repeat themselves during the day? How can we get ourselves back? Picture the cover and the title of Robert Woodward's book that came out last Tuesday as I see that image. It is titled simply Fear in capital letters. And the orange red of fire is the color of the cover. And in the cover is the outline of the president's face. Fear and hell and politics. Whatever the content, just looking at it makes my heart beat in a different way. My anxiety goes up. Remember the quote by Ernst Cassera from our readings and his biography of Hosea Ballou, in which he connects universalism and the democratic spirit? With the rise of the democratic spirit in the era of the American Revolution, it's not surprising that the Calvinistic belief in the election of some people to everlasting life and the condemnation of others to everlasting hellfire for no apparent reason should be challenged. Universalist sentiments arose naturally among those who could not accept an aristocracy of the spirit any more than they could accept a political aristocracy. So now, when for so many of us democracy feels threatened, does our fear of and for the political system then become that existential fear that keeps us jazzed up and once resided in God. Does this existential fear now get between us and the larger love in which we live? Are we intimidated? But you came this morning hoping to hear how to face these fears. I saw a smile and a nod and kind of a, yeah, that's right. So get on with it. This better be good. Again, I'll turn to the experience of my daughter. The outdoor adventure company she works for, Adventure Treks, uses a concept of reasonable risk to help children, but let's just say people, step out of their comfort zones in a safe, supported, and in their case, supervised manner. How do they address their fears? They accept that risk and the fear that goes with it is a normal, healthy part of life, but they learn to step back, to make judgments, and assess the real risk and evaluate the probabilities of success and the consequences of mistakes. They say about their campers, "We want to set a framework for a life that is neither risk-averse nor risky, but that embraces the calculated, reasonable risks we all need in order to grow, in order to live, in order to get through the day, in order to not be intimidated so that we can reach out in the world." In order to assess the risks, you have to face and name your fears. Are they real? Do they really affect you? Do you really know what they are? Are they something you can affect with your choices? That brings them into reacting and responding to fear rather than being controlled by anxiety. Are they something you can affect with your choices? Do you have the skills, the support to take them? What are the likelihood and consequences of making a mistake? Have you reasoned through your fear? Can you? Is it a risk you want to take? There's a triage that I used to do before I ever ran a rapid, and it was told to me by Gordon Grant. He said, "Can you see the skill? Can you see the moves you need to make? Do you have the skills to make them?" And then he goes, "Are you willing to live with the consequences when you mess up?" Reasonable risk. Almost everyone I told that I was going to El Salvador for vacation expressed concern for my safety. Before I made the decision to go and bought plane tickets, I researched the safety of the country and learned how I could be there in a safe way, or in a way that felt safe to me. I read about it and talked to people who had recent experience there, and then I reached a point where the risks seemed reasonable to me and for me. And after I got there, I continued to learn and fine-tune my sense of how to be there. And as a result, I had this fine and wonderful experience. As we watched the approach of Hurricane Florence, we saw how the danger was hyped and how our fears were magnified. We also had to evaluate what was going to happen to us and how much preparation we needed to do. But then we got to watch as the calculations of reasonable risk changed with each day and with the luck of the draw and how Florence tracked and where you happened to live. Almost all the people on the coast decided they needed to move. Some decided to stay, and from a distance, it was hard to see how that was reasonable. But some were unable to leave. It wasn't a decision. And now as the storm moves through, our hearts are moved by the suffering and devastation that we see at a distance, but with strong feelings and reactions nonetheless. And as we can see this morning, here it took a while for our awareness and concern to shift from the images we were seeing from the coast to the realization that we were not in danger, to the realization that we could experience winds and rain that resembled more a passing cold front than a tropical storm. Some of us were still expressing worry about hurricane effects into Friday. We were still reacting to the images and watching the Weather Channel and not getting to the point where it said what was going to happen here because that wasn't exciting news. They weren't reporting it. We hadn't looked at the NOAA graphs of expected wind and rainfall. We had yet to reason through the fear and risks, the drama of what we were seeing and the words we were hearing. And when we did, at some point, we knew we would be able to go about our business for the most part. And it was reasonable to expect to be able to buy groceries Saturday afternoon if we needed them and come to church on Sunday morning if we were okay with getting rained on a bit. Last Sunday, as part of our congregational conversation, we talked about how we might replace our Love is Love, All Are Welcome banner that was torn down for the second time. I can tell you that as I stood in the sanctuary this morning, those conversations were going on before the service. It was a good conversation we held, and I realized that we are a community. We are a group in conversation about reasonable risk. We don't want to be risky, and we don't want to be risk-averse. We want to feel safe. We don't want to live afraid. We respond as we learn. Since the banner first went up over a year ago, we implemented a safety protocol. Ken Blackwell's sitting back there watching security cameras, and the doors are locked. We are courageous, and we don't want to be intimidated. But we are a congregation, a community. And what seems reasonable risk for you may not seem reasonable to me. You may love to ride the intimidator. And you may think I need to join you in riding the intimidator. And I thought through whether knowing the statistics and knowing that it's been there for all these years and nothing's happened would get me back on the intimidator. There is no way. And so, we are in conversation to listen and assess, to see what kind of community we can be so that we might better understand the calculated reasonable risks that help us be fully alive and that we are willing to embrace. And as our closing hymn says so well with its new words and new title, we are answering the call of love rather than reacting to fear. So I've taken the calculated risk of this morning of putting too much into this talk. But before I close, here's one more notion to take with you as you practice trying to reduce the volume of fear in your life. It's the importance of being a non-anxious presence. Rabbi Edwin Friedman was writer, counselor, consultant, and an expert on systems theory. And where systems are any connected group, organization, congregation, community, your family is a system. Our nation and our government are systems. And for any system to grow and change and function well, it needs non-anxious presence. An anxious system doesn't work well. Person or leaders who recognize the anxiety in the system but do their best not to take that anxiety on and not to amplify it, not to take it into their person and make it become fear. And to the degree that they are non-anxious, they actually change the system. He talks about non-anxious presence in relation to leaders, but I would suggest that each of us must lead the non-anxious presence in each of our lives. Touch into it, sit back into it, call it forth, take a deep breath, return mindfully to the present and the strong courage in each of our hearts. Remember to breathe. Universalism is that foundational, existential, non-anxious presence that we hold within and we step out from. It is a mindfulness that allows us to face our fears and be in conversation more fully with life and love. Being non-anxious and engaged becomes its own important action for change. I would say it is a calling. We are called to respond. So how are we to respond when we feel that the world is on fire? We respond in love. We check to see if, in fact, something is on fire. We remember to breathe and look around. We then look back to what we can do to make a difference. And then we draw from and on our own non-anxious presence. Breathe. You can do it. You can feel that it makes a difference. So that each day we rise to a new dawn. We face our fears with heart, with courage, living reasonable risks to find the life and love and joy that await us on our adventure of the next part of our life, even in the wind and the rain. We go out the door into the gift of a new day and another opportunity to be alive, another opportunity to do our work, another opportunity to answer and live into the call of love. Thank you for being here so I might face my fears in love, so that we might better face our fears in love.